This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'll speak first and warm up the crowd for Mr. Mowat. I'm doubly thankful to be here, first because this is my institution for 6 years. And also because John Mowat was my professor at a prior institution for a couple of years. So it's a really nice honor to be back. I want to talk today, when Aaron asked us to do something on the civilization of the cinema, which is a term that Deleuze uses often, I had an idea in mind, and I think I've changed my mind. In fact, what I want to talk today about is a little bit about language. And actually, I know this is going to jive with what John's going to talk about. And then weave my way into this question of civilization. So the talk is called The Incivility of the Cinema. And the first part is called What's Language Got to Do with It? In the time image, Gilles Deleuze defines the cinema's most pressing problem in terms of its relationship with language. And it is in light of this contention, seemingly so obvious, that I want to begin to approach the idea of a civilization of images. At first glance, of course, this assertion, Deleuze's assertion, clearly reflects the long history of attempts to understand the cinema as a linguistic system, attempts that range, I'm sure everyone has heard something of this, from casual allusions to the Esperanto of images to the elaborate extraction of a cinematic syntagm. Hence, when Deleuze affirms language as the cinema's foremost problem, he effectively prefaces his own deliberation on the possibility of a semiology of the cinema, and more specifically, a consideration of the work of Christian Metz. It is to his great credit, says Deleuze, that Metz asks, quote, under what conditions should the cinema be considered a language, rather than asking, in what way is the cinema a language? And there is a difference. Since the former cautiously poses the question of a cinematic language as a question of right, rather than gesturing toward empty or abstract universalism. And yet, if we turn to Metz for his initial rigor, and many people still do, we also turn to him because his rigor symptomatically gives rise in his work to all manner of approximation and analogy. And this is what Deleuze says, quote, substituting an utterance for an image, Metz can and must apply it to certain determinations which do not belong exclusively to the language system, langue, but condition the utterances of a language, langage, even if this language is not verbal and operates independently of a language system, unquote. Whence begins a critique of film semiology so devastating that not only is Metz's problem, or rather project, virtually demolished, I mean, I think it's kind of a de-pantsing in a certain way of Metz, but Deleuze's initial statement about the cinema's most pressing problem is raised to a problem in its own right. And I don't have time, obviously, to go into to this de-pantsing of Christian Metz, except to say that at one point, a common friend of ours told me a story completely apocryphal that Metz had actually committed suicide because of Deleuze's critique, that somehow this was like, a French chef losing a star and plummeting or something. But it really is that devastating a critique. My concern is that it raises a genuine problem within not only Deleuze's work, but a problem of language. If the semiological impetus of the cinema can be so summarily undermined, then why does the cinema's most pressing problem lie in its relations with language? If we now conclude that the semiological project, which seeks to align or analogize the cinema with language, suffers from insuperable approximations, and if instead Deleuze promotes a semiotics that refuses to draw upon the model of language, and I think that's the essence of what he's doing with Helmslev later on, then why is the relationship of cinema and language the medium's most pressing problem, or even a problem at all? The answer I want to pose here is that the problem of language consists in the actual materiality of spoken language in the cinema, namely the talkie. Now, readers of Deleuze's books may well be surprised by this argument, especially insofar as the philosopher is all too readily identified with a sort of paradigm of film history that, I think is generally associated with people like Bazin and to a certain degree Jean Mitry. It's a paradigm that seeks to shift the coordinates of cinema studies away from the introduction of sound altogether. Ostensibly, Deleuze has always seemed to belong to this lineage of critics who considered the great divide between silent films and talkies to have been wildly exaggerated. Critics who refused the sense that cinema had been killed or at least hijacked by the introduction of sound. As André Bazin wrote in the 1950s, quote, "Now that sound has given proof that it came not to destroy but to fulfill the Old Testament of the cinema, we may most properly ask if the technical revolution created by the soundtrack was in any sense an aesthetic revolution. In other words, did the years from 1928 to 1930 actually witness the birth of a new cinema?" Unquote. Ultimately rhetorical in nature, the question forms the basis for the reorientation of film history that Bazin would undertake in his essay on the evolution of the language of cinema. The irony, of course, is that Bazin affirms the evolution insofar as the literal sense of language of the talkie has been displaced from the more general sense of the cinema's stylistic resources. The introduction of sound does not form the great historical divide of the cinema, but rather the illusion of the divide that has kept us from intuiting the elaboration of an aesthetic development that began long before the talkie and that would continue apace well after its instantiation and institutionalization. Likewise, in the penultimate chapter of The Time Image, The Components of the Image, Deleuze seems to follow this party line. Quote, "The break between the talkie and the silent picture and the resistances it produced have often been emphasized," he writes. "But it has also been shown with just as much justification how the silent film called for the talkie, already implied it. The silent film was not silent, but only noiseless, as Jean Mitry has said." And I think you can see there's a way in which Deleuze is, yes, he's following Bazin, but there's a way in which also I think those who have read him and not read very carefully have conflated his argument with Bazin's. And so I want to say, and yet, this admission serves to countenance a formula for silent film that, if we are not sufficiently delicate, we are apt to miss. And here's the formula. Silent cinema is never truly silent because it possesses language, but what it lacks is speech. In the Aesthetics and Psychology of the Cinema, which is an absolutely incredible book that Mitry writes and that Deleuze leans upon a great deal, Mitry contends that silent cinema was, quote, "silent but never without sound," by which he means, quote, "the odd cries, sounds, or even words suggested by the characters' descriptions were understood by the audience, which had to use its imagination to provide the characters and objects with the sound qualities they might have had in reality. And star-struck girls credited the romantic leads with the sweet nothings they longed to hear." I think this might be a throwaway statement for some, but for Deleuze it's not. And what he takes up is something like this. In his or her imagination, then, the spectator converts evidence of speech, or what we might call empiricities, into a kind of dialogue. The result of which is that the experience of silent cinema was, we might say, mute but not silent, speechless but by no means beyond language. This paradox is most clearly revealed when we consider the example of the intertitle. So the intertitle is when you're watching a silent film, you know, you flash to this black screen, there's an intertitle that says, you know, a Sunday outing or something of that kind, or even says what a character would have said. In the first place, of course, the intertitle renders any form of language, even the speech act, in terms of writing. and thus as a function of what we see. The speech act as such is not a spoken act at all, but what Deleuze calls a visibility, such that the spectators must invariably transpose what is read or seen into the noiselessness of that which, quote, would have been said, unquote. The absence of actualized speech or active speech condemns any statement to an indirect existence, such that the intertitle, and this is Deleuze's example, I am going to kill you, would properly be read, he says, he is going to kill him. Okay. Thus, we might say that while the silent cinema possesses recourse to language, what it lacks is the modality of speech according to which language is actualized. In short, what it lacks is discourse. Emile Benveniste famously defines discourse in the widest possible sense, not as the designator of a modality of speech, like a discourse on politics, but rather as a consequence of speech itself, which is to say, quote, every utterance assuming a speaker and a hearer, and in the speaker the intention of influencing the other in some way. It is primarily every variety of oral discourse of every nature, of every level, from trivial conversation to the most elaborate oration. All genres in which someone addresses himself to someone, proclaims himself as a speaker, and organizes what he says in the category of person, unquote. In his remarkable writings on pronouns and on verb tenses, however, Benveniste notes that the third person, as opposed to the other two, tends to function differently in most languages than the first or second person. And this is sort of where I'm going here. The latter, the first and second person, are rendered meaningful in the temporality of speaking, insofar as you and I are deployed and defined according to each new speech act. So I'm speaking to you now, I'm using the I, I'm embodying that I, but at a certain point if you ask me a question, those terms are going to be reversed, I'll embody the you, you'll embody the I, you see what I mean. By contrast, the third person is displaced from the discursive dyad, reduced instead to the spectral existence of another to whom you and I refer, but whose being remains inactive, inexistent, and inert. Indeed, Benveniste locates the degree zero of the third person in Arabic. For while Arabic literally marks the first person as the one who speaks and the second person as the one who is addressed, it designates the third person as the one who is absent, which is to say, a non-person. And in fact, this is my sense of what this silent cinema is about. In this sense, the silent cinema constitutes a cinema without subjects, or rather, a cinema whose characters and figures never attain subjectivity, but remain hermeneutically and beautifully enclosed within a visible sphere. This may explain the cinephilic attraction that silent film has exerted upon audiences and critics, and those critics range from people like Epstein and the Impressionists to people like Barthes in the third cinema, in part because the intertitle belongs to a strangely anonymous register of language that takes on what Deleuze calls, quote, an abstract universality, which in turn bathes the image in a kind of pre-symbolic affect. The silence of the cinema, by which we mean the visibility of everything, even language, confers on the image a kind of mesmerizing luminosity that Deleuze describes as the naturalization of the image. Quote, in the silent cinema in general, the visual image is, as it were, naturalized, as far as it presents us with the natural being of man in history or society, unquote. The intertitle imposes upon visibilities not another layer of the image, as Deleuze will suggest of the talkie, but an abstraction that seems to bear the silent image into, quote, an innocent physical nature, an immediate life that has no need of language, unquote. We must be careful not to conflate the physical quality of innocence with, say, a kind of primitivism, and I think that Deleuze himself sort of falls into this trap because he deals with a movie called Taboo, that is in some ways, I mean, enacting a kind of taboo, and because there are references aplenty to Rousseau that seem to suggest that this is that there's a kind of primitivism at work in silent cinema. But in fact, the silent cinema is perfectly capable, as we all know, of capturing images of modernity and of modern life. and even of the destruction and degradation of famine and poverty of modern societies. The point, rather, is that such depictions are imbued with a kind of naturalness, which always return us to the physicality of bodies and locations, of actions and reactions existing in the absence of what we call a subject. Now, what I've done is I've cut out a great deal of this talk, but I think that if one were to evoke something to sort of exemplify this sense of the silence of cinema, it would clearly be something on the order of, say, slapstick comedy, where bodies achieve a kind of plasticity and elasticity that they wouldn't normally have, say, in the comedies of the 30s. And there's a moment, Stanley Cavell, whom I don't particularly like, has written a piece fairly recently where he says that the characters of silent comedy are somehow invulnerable to the prospect of death. And I think that actually he's hitting upon something here, which is to say that these bodies, they're almost eternal. They're absolutely invulnerable to a sense of immortality, or to a sense, rather, of mortality. So having said that, this leads me to the second part of my talk, which is called Cinemas of Innocence and Experience. What the talkie seemed to lose, to lose, writes Deleuze, was the universal language and the omnipotence of montage, unquote. It is as if the naturalism of the image had been contaminated, degraded, and finally lost to us in the rush to see people speak on film. But if something is lost by virtue of speech, the image itself undergoes a profound transformation, inasmuch as the speech act is no longer connected with the second function of the eye, is no longer read but heard. When Deleuze evokes the talkie, he means the way speech introduces a new dimension to the image, as if the visible plane had been rerouted through different exigencies. The talkie, quote, makes visible in itself something that did not freely appear in the silent film. And this actualization consists not just in speech, but we might say in the development of an image of society. As Deleuze writes, quote, when speech makes itself heard, it is as if it makes something visible, something new visible. The visible image, denaturalized, begins to become readable in turn as something visible or visual. The emergence of this new image, which we can only begin to outline here, might be traced from the subject who emerges as an effect of speech, to interactions, in the form of which subjects actualize each other, and finally to society, in which the civilization of images is finally made manifest in the distribution of subjects and speech into vast temporal and spatial circuits. It is difficult not to read this transformation, as I've said, in light of Rousseau's narrative, to which Deleuze refers, and perhaps more implicitly in light of a certain kind of Hegelianism, which would confer on the transformation of nature a kind of status of civil society. In part, and I think this is really where I'm going, in part the strange naturalization of silent cinema appears to have been sublated by the consensual agreements of civilization, in which an ethical order of contract, agreement, and self-realization is conditioned, and finally in which the state itself, or at least the prospect, the specter of a state's form of cinema, is prefigured. And we're all too familiar with the forms of such a state cinema, of what Deleuze has called Hitler and Hollywood, Hollywood and Hitler. But in a sense, both the determination of this mode of cinema and the hope for an alternative mode, which I want to talk about today, remains to be understood in the context of speech itself. So let me return to the subject of cinema, in whom speech and sight are incarnated and who, in turn, is seen and heard. The subject is not the one who speaks, but he or she who is spoken, whom discourse colonizes, organizes, and distributes in space. And we might begin to see traces of this epistemological and technical development in the cinema. We've already suggested above that subjectivity itself is produced only inasmuch as unique But mobile signs of the I, of the you, are deployed and spoken since, quote, and this is Benveniste, it is by identifying himself as a unique person, pronouncing I, that each speaker sets himself up in turn as a subject, unquote. The subject, however, only produces and affirms its existence insofar as he or she addresses an other, who in turn addresses that subject, him or herself. Benveniste attributes to the I-U pair a correlation of subjectivity, a correlation that does not pre-exist each speech act, but that emanates from the relations of those acts within conversation. And this is sort of getting to where Deleuze is really interested in the nature of speech. The talk, he says, Deleuze, takes on an area that might be called human interactions, which are distinct from both previous structures and consequent actions or reactions. If actions and reactions dominated cinema in the absence of speech, the talkie makes them, quote, conditions or consequences of the speech act, while interactions themselves are the correlate of that act and only show themselves in it, through it, as the reciprocities of the IU relationship, the interferences corresponding to communication. And this is what Deleuze says, quote, it would be wrong to consider conversation in terms of partners who are already joined and linked. Even in this case, the specificity of conversation lies in its distribution or redistribution of the stakes, and its initiation of interactions between supposedly dispersed and independent people who pass through a scene by chance. And at some point I want to show a very brief clip, but I have a sense that what we're really talking about is the way that speech achieves a kind of autonomy of its own that in a certain way speaks through characters but also speaks independently of them. And I think in a certain way that's the greatness of cinematic language. There's a wonderful quote by Alejo Carpentier where he talks about the failure of dialogue in he talks about the failure of dialogue in the novel form and in the theater, especially in the theater. And it seems to me that what we really look to the cinema for, especially the cinema of the 1930s, is a kind of sociology that redresses these lapses, this sort of theatricality of speech. On the one hand, then, speech distributes subjects within a visible field, thereby organizing the visible itself or the determinations that we call, following Kant, space and time. The infinite lament at the loss of the silent cinema is often mounted in the recognition of the territorialization of visibility by speech that we see and hear in this vast process of mounting a talkie. And there can be no doubt that at first the technological demands of synchronized sound and especially the immobility of the microphone enfeebled the actualization of that which we see. The preposterous scenes of actors huddled around a hidden microphone suggest a kind of profound circumscription, not only of bodies themselves, but also of camera movement and montage, which are henceforth linked to the continuity of speech. And Mitry writes, quote, film found itself forced to keep to a more tightly scripted series of sequences, with more precise matching from shot to shot, and thence from sequence to sequence, unquote. On the other hand, though, the technological limitations introduced by synchronized sound profoundly determined the prospects of speech itself, of what can be heard. Precisely because bodies are moored to certain spaces rather than free to roam those spaces, or to move from one space to another, or in fact really to create a sense of the off-screen or off-space, the nature of speech in the cinema gravitated to that of the theater, where dialogue itself has been historically charged with developing psychologies and describing scenarios. And it's this sense of stage dialogue that Mitry says, quote, informs us as to the thoughts, feelings, and intentions of the heroes. Such dialogue is permissible, even necessary in the context of the theater, insofar as there is no gap in the theater between what people say and what they are. Since characters are able to signify themselves only through their words, they have no choice, as much as to justify their actions as to be understood. This is not true of the cinema, where a major area of interest is precisely this twilight zone between where characters can be revealed beyond what they say. The purpose of speech in the cinema is not to add ideas to images. Hence, we might say that the talkie always consisted in the possibility of developing another modality of conversation that would be discovered, or was discovered, earlier on. And I think that really this is the reference that for me is the most important. It's a reference to Georg Simmel and what he called sociability, which is to say a form of interaction that neither relies on psychology to determine space nor relies on space to produce psychology. Rather, quote, talk becomes its own purpose. And Simmel adds, this is what he says, conversation as such constitutes a play whose forms, quarrel, appeal, pacification, quote, derive their significance from themselves, from the fascinating play of relations which they create among the participants, joining and loosening, winning and succumbing, giving and taking. And I think that this is the point, that somehow when you encounter certain forms of sociability, when you're at a party and you're just making small talk or talking about the weather or some such bullshit, really, I mean, it is sort of what he's talking about is the fabulation of a kind of bullshit, and that's really a good word for it. You reach a point of where language itself is incredibly contracted, where we're just playing out a kind of a completely emptied or evacuated code, and then at a certain point where we stop playing that code and begin to play parts, so that, you know, you're walking in some party at a certain point and someone asks you what you do for a living, and you don't answer entirely honestly, or you answer in a way that, you know, because you feel like, oh, I don't want to be involved in this stupid conversation, I think I'll just, you know, say I do something completely different. It's moments like that Simmel and that really Deleuze is interested in. In this respect, conversation assumes an autonomous existence that distributes itself not simply in terms of certain unwritten rules, but as Deleuze argues, in terms of the subject, in terms of the evocation of what a subject is, rather than a pre-existent subject. And this is what he says, quote, the less of a pre-existing social structure there is, the better it is revealed. Not a silent not life, or not a silent natural life, but pure forms of sociability, necessarily passing through conversation. And conversation is undoubtedly inseparable from structures, places and functions, interests and motives, from actions and reactions which are external to it. But it also possesses the power of artificially subordinating all these determinations, of making them a stake, and of making all the others variables in that stake. Now, I thought that in order to sort of give you a sense of what I was going to talk about, because I know that John is not going to show any clips, so we figured we needed some actual visual entertainment, that I would show you a moment from a Ruben Mamoulian film from the 1930s called Love Me Tonight. It's really just about the beginning of the film, and it's a very cheesy film. It's a musical. But there's something fantastic that goes on at the beginning of the film, whereby a song gets relayed from participant to participant, from one person to another, from one geographical location to another, such that the narrative is no longer concerned with actions and reactions, but is really, in effect, is led and it opens up to what we might call the legibility of speech, to seeing what speech actually is. Can everyone see now? Yes. Not the best.
The romance of the sea is so clear that I can win. out of soy as man voided, man in the contrary to the rhythm of romance. I will give a stitch if I don't get rich. Augustine Taylor, who has no custom, is like a sailor, no one will trust him. But there is magic in the music of my shield. I shed no tears, lend me your ears. Isn't it romantic? Soon I will have found some girl that I adore. Isn't it romantic? Well, sit around, my love, can scrub the floor. She will kiss me every hour. Oh, she gives the sack. And when I get a shower, she can scrub my back. Isn't it romantic? On a moonlight night, she'll cook me onion soup. TVs are romantic. And if we don't fight, we soon will have a trump. We'll take the population. It's a duty that we owe to France. Isn't it romance? Isn't it romantic? Da-da-da-da-da. A very catchy strain. Isn't it romantic? Oh, I forgot my cane. Oh, thank you very much. I will fix your tie. Goodbye. Isn't it romantic? Oh, no, I need some air. Isn't it romantic? At last I thought of hair.
I'm running out of time, so I'm going to wrap up. And in part, I wanted to wrap up with this sort of this image of soldiers sort of singing, because in a sense, I think that there's something more at stake to this question of language and sociability than merely a new relationship between, let's say, sight and sound. In fact, I think that what's really at stake is, at least as far as Deleuze is concerned, something that spills over. And so the last part of the talk I had actually called Cinema 3, the power image, which in part I think that it's possible to say that what happens in Deleuze's two cinema books is that he begins this meditation on sight and sound, and that it ends up culminating in his book on Foucault. And that somehow the first book was a book on the movement image, the second book is a book on the time image, the third book begins to be concerned with an image of power. And the first thing to say is that that's not a possibility in a certain way. It's not possible to imagine power, not as Deleuze or Foucault define it. But it's possible to say a couple things now about power and to talk about the relationship that power affects between what Deleuze calls the sayable and the seeable. Let me think. In effect, where Deleuze begins his book on Foucault is by saying that Foucault is always working with two fields, what he calls early on the discursive and the non-discursive, but which later on amounts to what are called articulations or statements or sayables on the one hand, and what are visibilities or light even for Deleuze on the other. And it's somehow in the stratification of the two that we see or glimpse power, though not power as such, because in fact, as I've said, that's not entirely possible. But something on the order of this is possible or made possible by the cinema. So in any case, I'm going to very quickly move through some of this stuff and then leave it at that. Contrary to popular belief, Foucault's devotion to discourse, to the regime of statements, or even to speech, does not exist at the expense of that which is visible, but rather emerges in relationship to that which is visible. The first two dimensions of the social apparatus, Deleuze writes, or those which Foucault draws our attention to in the first instance, are curves of visibility and curves of enunciation. Typically or stereotypically, we do consider Foucault the great analyst and philosopher of the statement. But statements only exist in relationship to the visible, without which they would blend into shadows. Perhaps it's in this context that we can grasp Hegel's fear of a night in which all cats are gray. For the absence of light would render any conceivable muddle of shadows in which statements themselves would have no positivity. In other words, the function of the visible is not merely contrastive, providing a backdrop for statements, since light forms the very field of receptivity in which statements take place. And this is really something to be said about the cinema, in which determinations are seen and felt. The subtle yet brutal shapes of the panopticon, for instance, where statements about criminality and recidivism define an architecture of suspicion, of self-suspicion, and of conscience. The power of cinema, then, and this is what I want to really get to finally, consists in the actualization of a visible field in a spoken one. The talkie does not merely add a soundtrack to already existing visibilities, but rather reroutes visibilities through a network of sayabilities, of speech acts, music, and even the profound silence that speech itself makes possible. Indeed, Deleuze suggests that the cinema constitutes an audiovisual archive in whose precarious relations we draw the diagram of a given assemblage. And both Foucault and Deleuze suggest that there is, quote, a mutual presupposition operating between these two forms, between the strata of that which is articulable and that which is visible. And yet they say this: there is no common form, no conformity, not even correspondence. The nonconformity that somehow still corresponds, which we see in the cinema all of the time, right? I mean, characters are speaking or describing things and those things appear, an eyeline match or a spoken match. The non-correspondence that somehow still corresponds, still communicates, hinges upon the function of a kind of schema of the imagination that conditions the passage between these forms. And in a sense, the key to any given apparatus lies in tracing this mysterious third thing. This third thing, this capacity it wants to produce the incommensurable strata of what we say and what we see, and thence to produce the illusion of their schematization, Deleuze calls power. But for this reason, power should never be identified with the schematism itself, which only serves to occlude the nature of power behind forms of society, of civilization, and state. When in fact, these are, quote, the dust thrown up by power, unquote, the image of the ostensible determinations. In fact, we might say that they only bear witness to power itself, when these strata in fact fail to correlate, thereby inducing the image of a disjunction that occasions the experience of that which we can neither see nor which we can speak, but which perhaps we feel, and we feel in the cinema. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Let me begin in the obvious place, not simply at the beginning, but by thanking the hosts, Aaron especially, for being so kind to bring me here, but also Karen for the very thoughtful and I thought even insightful and penetrating words about my work in particular. I also want to thank Greg, because even though he made only the slightest of gestures in my direction, he has reminded me of something important, and that is it's often very hard, especially those of you who teach for a living, to know why it is that you do that. It's a grueling and often unrewarding activity. But you do it so that every once in a while you go somewhere and someone you taught get up and says, he made a difference, or she made a difference. Well, thank you for that. As Karen says, this is from a chapter in a book. I'm not going to read the chapter. But I am going to cover difficult material, and we'll try to do it in a reasonably rapid way. So I apologize at the beginning here for what may feel like a steep climb. The remarks that follow belong to a conjuncture whose relevant features, I think, bear brief description. To save time, I will stick to those features that press most immediately upon the institutionally organized study of the cinema in the global north, despite the fact that these features are distinctive to cinema studies only when looking from the inside out. At the risk of descending immediately into the realm of the cliché, consider that cinema studies, as something like a discipline or an academic field, is in crisis. This is not because enrollment in film courses is falling. On the contrary. Rather, cinema studies is in crisis because, one, and there will be a list of causes here, partisans have not figured out how to respond to the challenges, both institutional and intellectual, posed by the emergence of media studies. Two, because with the advent of computer-based filmmaking technologies, cinema studies can no longer patrol as effectively the border between film production and film study. Three, with the popularization of televised film commentary and criticism, Ebert and Roper, Hot Ticket, etc., cinema scholarship is succumbing to the stubborn anti-intellectual tendencies of American culture. And four, and I think most important of all, cinema studies is itself in desperate search of its object. What is the cinema? By this last, I wish to indicate that cinema studies is internally conflicted by competing claims concerning its specificity. Setting aside the theoretical discourses that in certain respects cut across different accounts of cinematic specificity, I think we can say that three objects are currently in contention. One, the cinema understood as text, which includes the spectator as one positioned within and by the text. Two, cinema as a social institution, which includes industries, audiences, styles, and national cultures. And three, cinema as thought, which includes an array of theoretical perspectives on technology, anthropology, and mind. As the evocation of conjuncture suggests, this search for an object is driven by pressures that do not arise from within the search itself. Were I to give these pressures a single name, globalization might be an appropriate one. This is not because my remarks will treat this vexed and vexing matter at any length, but because globalization does indeed tie together the threads enumerated above as features of the conjuncture of cinema studies. If it is important to clarify this at the outset, it is because the following discussion of enunciation, about which more in a second, is meant to intervene within and contribute to cinema studies in this dark hour. In short, I want to argue that enunciation can provide cinema scholars in the global north, but perhaps not exclusively there, with a theoretical concept cut to the jagged edges of the current conjuncture. As will be seen, the point is not to cover over or blunt these edges, but, forgive me, to enunciate them, that is, to produce them as problems that then worry the practice of cinema scholarship, but in a deliberate and reflective way. What then is meant by enunciation? Introduced within cinema studies almost 30 years ago now, enunciation was originally synthesized out of an interdisciplinary encounter between linguistics and psychoanalysis. And in fact, Greg has gone over a little of this terrain. But then enunciation, at that time, enunciation referred to the source, the mode of production of the statements that comprised the form and content of any given film, and it was understood to be split off from those statements or from what Metz, following Benveniste, called story. That's the sort of evil twin of discourse that Greg was talking about, story. Criticized for being too caught up in the linguistic turn, this was a charge leveled often against the partisans of enunciation. Enunciation has, as I think was said often and routinely about women smokers, come a long way, baby. And it's the trajectory of this way that I'm going to try to track for you in what follows. Now, I'm going to talk about really three different figures. And since this is going to go on for a bit, I apologize, what I'm also providing you with here is a way to measure how much longer you have to sit and listen. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Slavoj Žižek. I'm going to talk also here a bit about Homi Bhabha, and I'm going to finish by saying a bit about Deleuze's collaborator and longtime friend, Félix Guattari. Right? So if you want to know where we are, just remember that little map. No doubt the most important recent contributions to the dialogue between psychoanalysis and the cinema have come from the so-called Slovenian school, and perhaps most importantly, Slavoj Žižek. Though his thinking has wandered far from the formulations that appear in the early book of his called Looking Awry, these retain their pertinence in the present context because of the explicit way that they take up the legacy of the concept of enunciation. And in particular here, what I'm going to try to show is that he changes the conversation about enunciation in an important way. The key issue is, instead of thinking of it as split off from something else, statements, what he tries to show is that there is a split within it, within enunciation itself. And that split is of interest to me. Given that the explicit aim of Looking Awry is to introduce readers to the thought of Lacan through reflection upon popular culture, it comes as no surprise when in the concluding chapter, Žižek dusts off and redeploys Lacan's distinction between the subject of the statement and the subject of enunciation. This is a distinction worked by Lacan for many, many years. Though characterized as having a properly linguistic provenance, the distinction is said to find its perfect use, as Žižek puts it, in elaborating the topographical relation between the ego and the superego when brought to bear on the question of ethics, which is a question Žižek is concerned with. Because Žižek is keen on delineating the ethics of fantasy, the formulation regarding the relation between ego and superego is introduced without further comment. However, within the context of the chapter Democracy and Its Discontents, a bit later in the book, the formulation acquires associations that I think are fully mine to tease out. Specifically, Zizek uses the concept of enunciation to describe the agency of the superego, arguing that the ego's capitulation to the superego's demand that it renounce enjoyment and adhere to the moral law is paired with, in fact, is driven by, a suspicion that the superego is courting the enjoyment it denies to the ego. The subject of the statement becomes the law-abiding ego, and the superego becomes the subject of enunciation. In both Zizek and Lacan, enunciation is thus associated with a modality of agency that is not, as it were, subject to the ego's exertions. However, by linking enunciation and the superego, a psychic instance consistently regarded as psychosocial by Freud, Zizek throws his weight behind those who give a social meaning to the agency that eludes egoic machinations. In doing so, he complicates this discussion in a decisive way by introducing a split now within enunciation. Moreover, he invites us to conceive of the split within enunciation, the split between the ego and the superego, along the lines of a social division, drawn not between the subject and society, but within the subject, insofar as it is a social being. Indeed, as the final chapter of Looking Awry unfolds, first democracy and then the nation are strained through the analysis of enjoyment, an analysis that in establishing the perfect use of the statement-enunciation pairing would appear to render indissociable enunciation and the varying formations of collectivity that bound and border the subject. Julia Kristeva, in both Strangers to Ourselves, but also Nations Without Nationalism, has elaborated these very issues in complementary and, I think, deeply suggestive ways. But the contributions here of Homi Bhabha are, in fact, I think, more immediately pertinent. This is largely because his formulations help sustain the effort to think the split of enunciation not simply in social terms, but in terms that matter to film theory, especially as it has struggled with the task of reflecting upon the relation between the cinema and globalization. To be sure, enunciation is a concept that circulates readily in Bhabha's prose, thus making any effort to provide a comprehensive account of its work difficult, if not simply doomed in advance. However, in his polemic, The Commitment to Theory, written in reaction to the Edinburgh Third Cinema Conference of 1986, enunciation is used to realize rather particular effects, indeed ones that are pertinent and also, thankfully, parsable. Much of the second part of the essay, where the discussion of enunciation takes place, is given over to nailing down his signature distinction between cultural diversity and cultural difference. This matters because in order to complicate the heritage of theory and thereby refute the charge that in being Eurocentric, it is irrelevant to considerations of third cinema, Bhabha must supplement the cliché that theory is a form of practice with the demonstration that despite appearances, theory does not belong to Europe. Presumably because the patient gray work of genealogy, this is a phrase that Foucault used to like, does not appeal to him, he makes his case by articulating a theory of cultural difference that renders Europe a stranger to itself, in effect, unlivable. Significantly, Bhabha deploys the Lacanian account of enunciation to realize this very aim. After glossing cultural diversity as an object of knowledge and cultural difference as the process articulating the intelligibility of such an object, he spells out the following relevant details. Quote, "The concept of cultural difference focuses on the problem of the ambivalence of cultural authority. The attempt to dominate in the name of a cultural supremacy which is itself produced in the moment of differentiation. And it is this very authority of culture as a knowledge of referential truth which is at issue in the concept and moment of enunciation. The enunciative process introduces a split in the performative present of cultural identification, a split between the traditional culturalist demand for a model, a tradition, a community, a stable system of reference, and the necessary negation of the certitude in the articulation of a new cultural demand. Cultural demands that manifest themselves also as meanings, strategies in the political present, indeed a confrontation with domination, or in that sense a form of resistance. End quote. Later, in order to drive home the structural implications of this argument, he adds, quote, "The linguistic difference that informs any cultural performance is dramatized in the common semiotic account of the disjunction between the subject of a proposition, the énoncé, and the subject of enunciation, which is not represented in the statement, but which is the acknowledgement of its discursive embeddedness and address, its cultural positionality, its reference to a present time and a specific place." And you, Greg, summarized some of this for you as well. "The pact of interpretation is never simply an act of communication between the I and the you designated in the statement. The production of meaning requires that these two places be mobilized in the passage through a third space," and he capitalizes that so we don't forget it, "which represents both the general conditions of language and the specific implications of the utterance in a performative and institutional strategy of which it cannot in itself be conscious. The splitting of the subject of enunciation destroys the logics of synchronicity and evolution which traditionally authorize the subject of cultural knowledge. In other words, the disruptive temporality of enunciation displaces the narrative of the Western nation, which Benedict Anderson so perceptively describes as being written in homogeneous, empty time." End quote. Of the many themes introduced here, those that subtend the link drawn between enunciation and what is called the third space solicit sustained comment. For not only are these the themes through which Bamba seeks to conceptually outmaneuver the third cinema partisans, but they are also the ones that, in circling back to Anderson's discussion of the nation, keep us, as it were, in the orbit of the problem of globalization. At first glance, Bamba, especially in reiterating the linguistic and psychoanalytical heritage of enunciation, appears simply to be restaging the distinction between statements and enunciation, thus avoiding altogether the split within enunciation. However, it is clear that in using formulations such as the splitting of the subject of enunciation, there is more here than meets the eye. What emerges, if one reads with a certain patience, is something like the following proposition. Precisely because statements about cultural identity, whether one's own or another's, are produced within the general process of cultural differentiation, inter and intra-cultural exchange, the subject of enunciation is not simply split off from his or her statements, but is split between and among the multiple cultures that condition the act of enunciation. In short, no culture is simply identical to itself, and the ambivalence that results cuts through and divides the process of cultural identification. If this process is, at a certain level, synonymous with enunciation, it is because producing linguistic statements is a bit like producing culture, except that the speaker is a conflicted collectivity, inevitably beset by other like and unlike bodies, bodies similarly traversed by the overarching social divisions of class, race, gender, and sexuality. Thus, for Bamba, like Žižek, all cultural values, all cultural meanings, marks of distinctions put in play through the work of cultural differentiation, are smeared by the conflicts waged through and around the production of those meanings. The authority of Eurocentrism from such a perspective derives from its partisans' suppressed activation of a conflicted relation, a cultural difference, whose projection onto a host of disadvantaged parties is in the last instance sustained by force of arms. I think it is important that enunciation be invoked here to designate the conflicted source of cultural statements, or to preserve the more ambitious formulation, the statement of cultures. For what results is a nuancing of the concept of the split when conceived in relation to enunciation. Instead of thinking of enunciation as divided by a clean cut from top to bottom, Baba's discussion invites us to think about it as divided both by its relation to statements and by the multiple conflicts it registers, once understood to belong to the production of cultural statements, or what I've been calling the statement of culture. In effect, what we get to here is a split within the split in enunciation. While perhaps not immediately apparent, these issues bear directly on the concept of a third space. Granted, given that Baba's reflection on this term ranges well beyond the limits of either this citation or this essay, my elaboration cannot but be partial. However, several of the important concepts of third space can be teased out with relative ease. To begin with, it is surely no accident that Baba introduces the concept in the context of the discussion of the deaxis, the personal pronouns, the I, the you, as if to express his solidarity with those dissatisfied with deictical reductions of enunciation. Baba insists that the production of meaning happens in another scene. Indeed, one where the utterance is implicated both in language as such and in a performative and practico-institutional context. This prompts him to appeal to the concept of a third space as a way to name the site towards which the pronominal places are routed in order for meaning to be exchanged. Strictly speaking, it is unclear whether this space is produced at the point of convergence between the place of the sender and the place of the receiver, or whether these places, insofar as they can be separated, presuppose the prior production of a third space. But the link to enunciation is pronounced in any case. It is so through the principle of the performative derivation of the utterance. By moving to subordinate the deictical relation to a process that subtends it, and in retaining in his characterization of this process the split between language and cultural context, it becomes clear that enunciation, precisely to the extent that it is multiply split or conflicted, belongs to what Baba is calling third space, that is, a space divided by two places, the language enabling their communication and the cultural context that differentiate those places. By further invoking the Lacanian concept of the unconscious in itself, he makes it difficult, if not impossible, to conclude that enunciation is not what he means when he talks about the production of meaning. In addition, it is not without interest that Baba implicitly superimposes the unconscious on a concept so obviously freighted with allusions to the geopolitical category of the third world. Ashish Nandi, while underreading the fact that Moses was an Egyptian, after all, but perhaps he had the last word on the tendency expressed here. This notwithstanding, I think Baba's comments, especially in the context of the Edinburgh Festival, invite us to underscore his equally pertinent allusion to third cinema. Certainly, as numerous commentators have observed, there is no easy equation between the third cinema and the third world. Indeed, some would no doubt argue that harking back to the third world is, as we now glibly say, so pre-9/11. This notwithstanding, Baba's formulations do invite one to speculate that enunciation may well be the crucial concept through which to situate the cinema within the spatial divisions that organize what Armand Matlaut understands in mapping world communication by the uneven world system of communication. In other words, if we accept that nations are culturally as well as politically unstable and therefore troubled constructs, then so too are national cinemas. Indeed, the cinema is a distinctly international institution, is fundamentally involved in producing this very instability. if national cinemas, precisely to the extent that they vie for cultural authority on the international scene, are subject to the interminable process of cultural differentiation, then they are dependent upon a third space that mediates and divides the encounter between senders and receivers of filmic messages, and about which they are, to varying degrees, unconscious. Because Baba is primarily concerned to protect the theoretical enterprise as such, he does not linger over the implicit task of specifying how filmic enunciation ought to be conceptualized in relation to third space. Nor does he really come to terms with the cultural political conflicts his own discussion at once reflects and theorizes. This does not, to my mind, vitiate the decisiveness of his contribution. It only clarifies the need to supplement his account of enunciation with one that recognizes the complexities he has delimited while refusing to abandon the political challenges that they pose. Now, this is the point at which I will talk about Guattari, but how are we doing? We have some more time? The sooner the better, right? All right. In which case, what I will do is summarize. See, losing audience already. Essentially, what Guattari tries to do is to develop this concept of enunciation by connecting it with something he refers to as a collective assemblage. This is not a concept that is unique to him. It is one that he develops in his working relation with Deleuze, about whom Greg has spoken at length. The aim is to draw attention to two things, really. One is the heterogeneity of enunciations in a film. And in particular, what Guattari tries to focus on is the interplay between sound and image, between types of sound, noise, voice, music, and aspects of the image, everything from its tonalities, its contrasts, its colors, etc. So that he is very, very aggressively trying to make enunciation into what he calls a polyvocity. There's another side to what he's doing as well, and this is that he is looking at enunciation as spread over many institutional sites. Right? And part of what he's doing, obviously, is acknowledging that in a film, the coming together of sound and image is a coming together that derives from many different locations. There's very often a novel, a short story or something that is brought to the work of creating the film. There's obviously camera work, lighting work, electrical work. There's an incredible array of sourcing gestures, things involved in producing the object. But he's also well aware of the fact that the cinema is international and has been international in character for a long, long time. And is really trying to use this idea of the collective assemblage of enunciation in order to draw attention to this rich polyvocal specificity within any given film, but then also this complex geopolitical dispersion of institutions involved in producing and distributing films. What I try to do then in following out the logic of this is to show in what way he really radicalizes what I've been calling this split in enunciation. He keeps dividing the split, as it were. And in doing so, really does create a way to, I think, get at a very rich account of what we would call maybe the poetics or the aesthetics of the cinema. At the same time that he's looking, I think, in a very interesting way at the distribution of the cinema now as a sort of social and more than internationalized, globalized institution. The problem that I see in what he's doing is that he is operating with a kind of framework in which there is not sufficient attention to the asymmetries of that global space, so that the kind of problem that Baba is interested in with third cinema is not one that Guattari is thinking carefully enough about. I think that has a lot to do with the distinction drawn in his work between what he calls micro-political and macro-political problems. In an uncharitable moment, I characterize micropolitics as not worth the effort if essentially we're talking about microbreweries. Right? This is not an interesting concept of micropolitics. I think that can arise when there isn't sufficient attention to the articulation between the micro and the macro. But the thing concludes really by trying to draw out how these three formulations, starting all the way from the beginning of the project with Žižek looking at Baba, concluding with Guattari, really do suggest that there's something interesting and important happening to this concept, which its earlier detractors have not paid any attention to. So I'll simply stop at that point and just tell you that the ending was better when I ran. Where was the bullshit?
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that both of the talks on cinema really address the issue of speech and enunciation. I wouldn't even say enunciation of speech is cinema. I say and that cinema has it's not enough to be a student of cinema. The question of what is and I was thinking cinema, rather than that usual kind of modernist narrative that the emergence of the talk kind of has decided in America, the emergence of the talk is, in a sense, the death of certain experimental possibilities of certain cinema based purely on God and its ability and certain harnessing of cinema to more epic narrative purposes. But I began thinking that really. Might be possible to think about is that actually the emergence of speech in cinema is the emergence of speech as a form of disability. And the question of enunciation is the question of what are collective assemblies, in other words, what are the distributions and organizations of discourse, both in national departments but also in local departments, that in a sense give certain collective assemblies. Speech is a function of cinema, a certain resonance that gives it an enunciated culture and a goal. So that's just what I was thinking about. The irony of listening to talk about cinema, speech, at the same time, thinking about the visibility of speech.
Well, one of the things that you remind me to stress, and if not in this, at some other point, is the important way, and I think Greg touches on this too, that the so-called coming of sound threatened the internationalism of cinema, and that there's a very important connection between a certain version of its collective assemblage status, especially understood now as internationally collected, and literally the advent of sound. And, you know, there's been a lot of work done on the problems that arise under those circumstances. And I think that, you know, one of the things that becomes important there is not getting too concerned about articulating the problems and tracing their histories, and instead continuing to ask a sort of version of Deleuze's question, which is, why is this a problem? In other words, what is it that speech is thought to be such that it becomes a problem in this context? And that really makes it more of a question about how you think about this object called the cinema, or the talkie, or whatever. And I guess, you know, that seems to me to be the framework within which, you know, both of us are sort of working here. We're trying to get some kind of conceptual purchase on something going on in a medium where, sure, you know, we have plenty of solicitation from within to locate its speech or its language or whatever. But it's still a matter of what are the productive ways of thinking about what's going on. And, you know, I think that that's why you will find, and not only here, and I'm not trying to excuse myself, but not only here, a lot of attention to phenomena that may not strike us immediately as cinematic. You know, still trying to get a piece of distance there to look at what's taking place in what is imagined to be a useful way. But
I really like the first part of your answer. I mean, no, I like the entirety of it, but I think it's really important to think about the potential. I mean, I hesitate to use the word, but the hegemony of Hollywood in light of the production of a sound cinema, that it was, and I think that really, in effect, even today, the way that English is somehow, and now it's there's a terrible sort of phrase which we use in the Academy now, global English, right. Which means reading other works in English that should be read in the native text or native language. But I think that in a certain way, the hegemony of Hollywood had everything to do with capturing and mounting a certain way of creating a sound cinema. I mean, there was the potential for a sound cinema existed long before, you know, 29, which is sort of an arbitrary date. And Warner Brothers had been sort of experimenting with it for quite a while. And I think that, I mean, I like to think of sound cinema because I think that what the cinema does is, and I think that John is saying this in a far more elegant fashion, is that it in a certain way, it underscores and emphasizes the singularity of what it means to speak. That, and that's to answer your question, it not only does it make speech visible, and I hesitate to use that term, I think that what Deleuze uses is a very sort of pregnant word. He says it makes it legible, which is to say that there's a way in which when speech enters the cinema, we're capable of reading an image in a completely different way, so that the speech becomes visible at the same time that the image itself becomes legible. And that has to do with a kind of interaction, a negotiation, and this is where I'm sort of unable to finish at the end, the actualization, really, and that's a loaded word, of a disjunction between the two, of these two strata that make each scene or each heard in relationship to the other, but as a non-relation, as an impossibility or an incommensurability. And it's at that point, that flash, that Deleuze says, there's power. Power becomes a problem at that point. And I think that the sort of the more profound way that I think that I potentially gestured toward John's talk is in suggesting that there is a way in which the cinema, as much as it's always been a kind of a state apparatus, or at least potentially so, it's possible for the cinema to be the apparatus that shows us that the state itself is not where power is. And I think that's why I want to talk about speech. And the other reason, just to answer Greg's question, is I'm just really tired of the fetishization of a time image, you know, as if that's the only thing in the cinema. At a certain point, it's run its course. You know, we need to talk about other things.
To be honest, I don't know if that was what it was, so I'm not sure if it's actually a question for you or a question for him, but he's not here, so I'll ask you. So the question is, I'm not here when we're talking about where the written word and the inner titles, as opposed to the spoken word, sometimes are playing a sort of third person role. Basically, what we're saying, you know, the character is now moves and then. He said, what? And it struck me that might be too simplistic, just sort of association of the written word with the third person and the spoken word with the first or second subject. Or at least there's more easier. So imagine a situation, I think it's analogous to what's going on. So you and I are sitting in a room with a clear soundproof glass wall between us. But fortunately for us, there's a little sort of computer built into the wall, microphones, printers, and you and I can communicate with each other. So if I speak, the microphone will pick it up on this very smart computer and end up printing it out on what I said out on your side. And vice versa, when you speak, it'll appear on your side and print out on mine. So there's an intuitive sense in which we can still communicate quite effectively this way. For most intents and purposes, it seems like, unless we like the sound of each other's voices, for most intents and purposes, we don't care. Right? I mean, we may care enough, you see what I'm saying, but the philosophical sense of discourse and communication, at least in an intuitive level, ought not to make a big difference. But on the sort of picture you're sketching in the first half of your talk, it sounds like that sort of situation would make a very big difference. I'm just wondering if you see this as any sort of tension or problem.
I think there's a slight reductivism in the way you pose it, but actually let's play that out. I think that's potentially useful. The first thing is that there are a whole variety of inner titles. I mean, they're the kinds that say that, you know, you encounter in the sort of the earliest Lumiere films where it just says, you know, baby eats a meal or something like that. But I think that the more interesting inner titles are the ones that sort of claim to be speech acts, where someone says, I'm going to kill you. And often the case is that, yes, occasionally we see a person say this or seem to say it on screen or mouth it, and then we see the inner title. But often we don't even see the mouthing at all. We just see the inner title itself. And maybe a more sophisticated way of talking about this is not to talk about it merely in terms of person, but also in terms of tense. There's a sort of, the French call it aorist or historical tense, that in a certain way all of these inner titles would, according to Deleuze, lapse into, that they would all ultimately be utterances, not, or they would never be uttered, but they would all be statements that describe an utterance, which is to say they would all sort of implicitly have the he said or the she said. I take your point, and frankly, I think it's sort of, I mean, my reductive version of your point would be that's what email is in a certain way. And gosh knows I like to use it precisely because I don't want to talk to people. my students. just kidding. But I think that, on the other hand, the rigor of Benveniste is to have pointed out at a certain place in time that the power of annunciation is always the power to incarnate and to embody. And he even says it, he writes this wonderful piece on Freud where he says, really, there's no way to talk about an ego itself without talking about a personal pronoun. And I would say that, actually, let's talk about this in the cinema in a certain way. There's no way to imagine a shot reverse shot without speech. It wouldn't be, it just wouldn't exist. It wouldn't be possible. And so I guess I want to defend the sense in which whatever that inner title is, and I think you're right. I think that there's more to be teased out here, a great deal more. Whatever it is, the nebulousness of it never achieves the sense in which it's truly discursive and the sense in which it's realized as actualized language rather than being just what is written. This is where Deleuze says, and this is where I wanted to be clear in answering Greg, that what's unfortunate about the inner title, and also what's very beautiful about it, is that it reduces what is said to a function of visibility. And I think that I would maintain that statement, despite your, I think, very correct sort of emendation.
Can I throw something in just quickly here? Deleuze's discussion is coming out of a pretty old French intellectual tradition mm-hmm. at the time that he gets it. And it's one that is concerned with the status of what they call the neutral voice, le neutre. Right? And it's the idea is to get at that curious place from which the narrator author's voice comes into the text. It's not in the conversation, but it's present on the scene. And if you think, for example, of inner titles in D.W. Griffith, where he has his little monogram in every corner, right? There's a sense there in which that speech is being marked as coming from outside the diegetic conversation and marking everything as reported by someone who is not responsible, not responsive, not accessible to you in the same way. So there's a thing there that's, I think, very important about how the cinema tries to occupy this space of what Blanchot called the neutral, this odd voice that's present but is not locatable.
Go ahead, Homer.
First of all, just thank you very much. These are wonderful talks. I feel like this kind of work is necessary in our lives and in our choices and all sides. My question is about the enunciation of images, and by that I mean visual images, because the list uses the term tonal sound as well as the tones. And I'm thinking about whether some of the properties of speech, as far as instituting and creating symbolic relations or facilitating exchanges and new alliances and correspondences among characters, can actually arise through the exchange of images or through the address of images to one another. And I'm thinking about the bard's characters holding up book jackets to one another. I'm thinking about also of Deleuze's own remarks on free and direct discourses and Pasolini there, but Pasolini was interested not so much in speech within cinema as in images were enunciated. So I'm very interested in just thinking about that.
Go ahead. You can take that.
Yes, I poached on yours.
No.
I think that the interesting thing that happened to enunciation that I didn't report on in the hands of Christian Metz, whom Greg referred to, is that he began to increasingly treat it as though what it really was about was the modes of reflexivity in a film text. And reflexivity could take the form of speech, certainly, but much more typically it would take the form of something like internal meta-commentary. So, for example, in A Bout de Souffle, when Patricia rolls up the poster of the Chagall image and looks through it as though it's a lens, there's an important sense there in which there are several pieces of the history of visuality that are being pulled together there to produce, right? Not just a relation between those characters, but an observation in the scene about the history of images and about this film's interest in placing itself in that history. So I do think that there, if the reflexivity side of it comes more into the foreground, then it seems to me there's no limit as to what kind of sign is relevant, indexical, iconic, symbolic, what have you. They're all capable, although in their own modes, of producing precisely that internal kind of meta-commentary, and in ways that I think can make the intertextual resonances of a film incredibly complex. But
no, I guess that there are two things that you said that I find interesting. I know that you work on that, and you've written on Free and Direct, so I won't sort of belabor you by telling you, I'm sure, what you already know. I find that section of Deleuze's work to be really intense, because I think it's a lot more complicated than people take it to be. I don't think it's merely about sort of taking the sense in which, you know, we could speak narratologically about Jeanette or someone like that, about free and direct discourse, and simply grafting it onto the cinema. There's a sense in which it's played out also with the sort of poles of objectivity, et cetera, that's really, really complex. But actually, I think I want to talk or address the first part of your question, which has to do with the way in which exchanges are possible or images are possible that are linguistic. And first of all, just having taught Hitchcock, I can only say that everything that Hitchcock does in a certain way has to do with that form of exchange, to the point often where where language itself is redundant. I think of this moment in North by Northwest where, I think everyone will know this, that's why I've chosen it, the moment where Cary Grant, is Roger Thornhill, is mistaken for George Kaplan, and you see this moment where the camera shifts away from Grant onto these two guys, tracks into them, and you know at that very moment, even if you've never seen it, and they look at him, and then one of them says Kaplan, and it's absolutely redundant at that point. It need not be said. And I think that a lot of sort of exchanges that Hitchcock mounts within movies are imagistic enunciations all the time. And I think that within Deleuze's work, there's a way in which we need to begin to talk about language at the end of the movement image with respect to what he calls thirdness. And it doesn't have to be about talking about language itself, but about talking about the prospects of enunciation. And I think this actually returns to something that John is saying, that's the reflexive moment in cinema at a certain point, this mode of thirdness, where it's not merely about perceptions or affections, it's about a kind of intellectual work that the cinema can do, whereby it enunciates what it is doing. And obviously, Deleuze's example is a great example, and it's one that I use because it's Groucho Marx, that he's the one who talks about, you know, what Chico and Harpo are doing all the time and somehow enunciates their relations. But I think actually in a certain way that it's the kind of example that if it's not treated particularly delicately, it'll come off the way that Zizek makes examples, which is to say that they are merely examples for a kind of examples within popular culture of a kind of intellectual something or other. But I don't think actually Deleuze means it that way. I think there's something a lot more there, especially insofar as, and these are the sort of films that I was thinking about when I wrote today, films of the 30s, where characters are often emerged in a kind of linguistic game playing where they're able to comment not on the games themselves, but on a certain kind of society, whether it's high society or gangster society. I think of the John Ford film, I'm not going to remember it, maybe someone will, where with Jean Arthur, where she's working for a newspaper and she, Edward G. Robinson becomes, do you remember the title of this? It's a film that marries the sort of gangster genre and the newspaper genre. And Deleuze's point is that these genres, they're like little societies where, you know, and they're not pre-given societies where they're hatched merely in the sort of modality of conversations. And I think that has everything to do with a reflexive capacity that these films are able to realize at a certain point. But that's, I think John is really, in a certain way, given the preeminent example of that. And Godard is doing it all the time. He's towards the cinema.
Yeah, I have a question for each of you. I wonder if I could just ask you something to be able to talk about to people who have studied. For instance, in cinema studies, I was wondering whether this frankly is really about articulating a split towards media studies or film studies and production. And I'm wondering if the interest of the film is that what the institution is to film studies is a way of utilizing that split as one of the strengths of the film, or if not that, then
what?
You go.
Next time you go first.
I know.
Fair enough. Oh. Since there are other questions, I'll just try to be very brief. Yes. No, I mean, less briefly. What I'm hoping is that there is a possibility for a conversation that hasn't, to keep with our metaphor of the evening, hasn't really found the right words to carry itself on, will become possible. And in that sense, I happen to be of the view that the tendency, for example, to separate out production and history and theory is a deeply mistaken tendency. And yet, understanding how it arose and what might be involved in transforming it, as I say, I don't think has the this is a figure from another field, the platform yet on which to work that out. And certainly my sense here is that enunciation elaborated with some of the detail that I'm providing here helps people think about, so how are you making this if you're making films? You know, what are the sourcing systems that allow for your statements to emerge? And do you know anything about the history of that? And, you know, so it produces something like this platform or these words, maybe one word.
First of all, I didn't show the end of the clip. The end of the clip does end with a woman, and she's singing on her balcony, and she's in fact the woman with whom, is it Marie Chevalier?
Yeah,
it is, with whom he'll end up later in the movie. So that in a certain way, the chain of I don't hesitate to call it signifiers, but the chain of language leads, or speech leads to her, thereby forecasting what will happen in the rest of the film. I take your point, and I do think that in a certain way, if not a kind of subjectivity, which I hesitate to use, obviously, given what I've just said, but a certain kind of representation of women maybe is foreclosed by the sound cinema. But I'm actually much more convinced that something else is opened. I think of something like Maria Di Battista's book on fast talking dames, or of, I mean, a whole bunch of work, not the least of which is due to Stanley Cavell and others, about the possibility for women speaking. And Cavell actually links this 30s cinema and the talkie to the suffragist movement in a certain way, and to a certain kind of feminism that he, I think far too innocently, he reads in terms of someone like Katharine Hepburn. And I'm not sure I buy that argument, but I certainly buy the fact that within these sort of genres, and especially within comedy, that it's, at a certain point I find it remarkable that screwball comedies are comedies because it's women who are so often in control, with the one exception often is Cary Grant, but that it's women who control discourse, that in a certain way they're the more playful of the lot, and as a result they tend to dominate spaces, cinematic spaces, and visibilities to a far greater degree than men do. Yeah. No, that's. I grant that. No, I'm just trying to show you the other side of the coin.
Mr. Fox, didn't you have a question? No. Comment. You sound like you're addressing that to me, and so I will answer first. Well, I mean, there is much interest, in fact, in film theory, in architecture, in space, in the way in which the cinema gives us access to space in a way that really participates in the cultivation of a kind of optical unconscious, you know, experiencing spatial organization in a way that one isn't otherwise aware of, and encountering it with a proximity and an intensity that is unusual because of the ability of such simple things as, for example, a close-up or a traveling sweep of a space that precisely through duration gives you a sense of immensity and whatnot. Beyond that, there is also a very famous discussion in the German writer Walter Benjamin about the way we experience film in the same way that we experience buildings. And what he means by that is that we use them in a kind of state of distraction. We don't enjoy them because they make immediate and deep sense to us. We have this encounter with them that is rather like the way we encounter the film. Because for him, the equivalent has to do with the way that building organizes activity in a way that's not often conscious to those who use it. And the claim is that the cinema, likewise, uses spectators, gets them to care, gets them their attention focused and whatnot, in ways that is exactly like a building. But you asked a more specific question about the word being used in cinema to open up space or our relation to it. And I think there are two things to say. One is we have to be careful about what we mean by the word, right? Because it seems to me that one of the implications of this conversation this evening is that the word, if we too quickly think about it as operating at the level either of an inner title or dialogue, isn't rich enough to talk about the way statements in film get produced, which often make no recourse to anything like language in the sense of words strung together according to a grammar. But the other point is to what extent, let's say, even language opens space in cinema. And it seems to me there are hundreds of ways to think about how that happens in, I think, very intellectually compelling ways. For example, the way in which speech can motivate camera acting. Very simple. You know. There he is. Cut away. So that the space of the diegesis, where the story is happening, is literally motivated by speech acts. Space that didn't exist before can be announced in that way. It can also be announced less in terms of the actual use of dialogue with sound to do the same thing. So that when you are looking into a space and a sound takes place there that doesn't belong to it, because you can tell from the resonance that's not from that space, the space of where that is opens immediately and engulfs and surrounds, and I think really shakes that kind of point of audition that we otherwise spectate from. But there's just a few things to say about that.
John has in part said what I'm going to say, so I'll keep this short. I don't get to at a certain point, but what I think is really important is that, and John has just mentioned this, that there are areas of space, or we could say even enunciations of space, that are made possible by not just speech, but by sound. And I think that in a certain way, you could enumerate them as follows. The first would be space or depth within a single image. And I think of sort of like moments in a film like Robert Altman's Nashville, where you have these sort of layers of conversation that are explored with the zoom lens and basically microphone levels that are effectively changed during a single shot.
It's an 8-track tape machine.
That's right, yeah. And then there's the very fact of a much earlier invention, which has to do with sort of the mobile microphone, which allows the possibility for exploring a space, or say if characters moving while talking at the same time. And I think the most, in some ways the most profound, and the one that say Deleuze talks about, has to do with the idea of an off-screen, and John's just mentioned this, and of the development of spaces. Really, I mean, actually, this is due in part to Noel Birch, who's a wonderful film theorist, that a lot of what we think about as off-screen is in large part indebted to the use of sound to develop spaces that we don't actually see. Having said that, I just think that I wanted to go back to the first point you made, which is to say the sort of determination of an image or of what we see by what we say or by statements. And I think of a very simple experiment that my mother forced me into as a child, which is going to the MoMA, which has just been renovated, and not forcing myself not to look at the titles of works of art in advance. And I think that it's actually sort of an interesting activity, but I think actually an even more interesting activity is when someone like Magritte takes, you know, what you say or what you've seen, which is a pipe, and says this is not a pipe within the context of that frame. And in a certain way, that's what Deleuze and Foucault have played off of for years, this disjunction between what is said and what is seen that produces a kind of, and I hesitate to use that, I don't think it's a negation, right, because the pipe is there. It's not a negation. What it is it's literally a caesura and a cut, a space between these two things, between words and things, that opens up at least a point where we have to think about them. And I think that that's a possibility that language has to actually, yes, at times it determines spaces and visibilities, but at times it prompts us to see them in completely defamiliarized ways. Yes. Yeah.
Thank you all.
Thank you so much, Karen. Aaron.